The Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network is brought to you by Onyx Hunt. Bringing you the best GPS mapping software directly to your smartphone or desktop, Onyx offers you the ability to see property boundaries, mark waypoints, track your location, and so much more. Visit onyxmaps.com or you can download it directly from your app store today. Save 20% off of your purchase by using the code NATION20 at checkout. That's capital N, nation, followed by the number 20.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you. Welcome, guys, to another Land and Legacy Podcast. It's March, man.
Oh, for sure. It's
how did we get here? How
and spring is happening very fast this year. For you guys up north, we're sorry. It's coming. We promise. But for everybody down south and here in the Midwest, the Mid-Atlantic, like I was driving down the road tonight or this evening, and I noticed this. I'm not even sure because we were going by, but there was some tree right over here in between my house and your house that was already putting on little blooms.
No kidding.
I'm like, wow. I looked, I was like, are you kidding me? My wife goes, well, it's March. And I was like, I don't know if you understand the significance of this, because March 8th, the last 2 years, still would have been very cold.
Very, very cold. Very much winter. It's very unique. But it's coming down to the wire when it comes to, wow, we've got spring just around the corner. This means this year we're transitioning a little bit, potentially, into some different management techniques earlier than what a lot of people are probably used to.
Yeah, and not shutting down,
shutting down
other techniques.
Absolutely they are. So it's a kind of this weird, unique transition, but one we all need to be taking note of and enjoying being outside. I was outside, I guess, the last 2 days in Kansas, spent some time. Besides the wind, temperature, just gorgeous. Like, and this past week's been incredible up here, 50s and 60s. So it's like, wow, I kind of like this. I like winter, but really I'm not complaining about the temperatures here that we've been having. So definitely excited about that.
So basically, if you're doing hack and squirt, even cutting oaks, it's not a great time to be continuing that from, you know, mid-Missouri, northern Kentucky, south, even West Virginia over in there. Anything below that line, time to halt all your timber management just for the time being and start working on trying to finish up your prescribed fire, cool season grasses, trying to control some of your turf grasses that are...
Which is that transition. Now they're starting to grow really, really good.
Yeah. So you guys up north, try to hammer out the last little bit of your timber stuff because it's coming very quickly.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, man. So
with that too, though, it's a good time to do a little Stratton seed.
Absolutely. A lot of orders coming through our website. A lot of people sending in. Yeah, a lot of people calling, a lot of emails, a lot of social media messages, people trying to prepare and get ready for planting season this spring. With that being said, it's a great time to thank one of our partners who makes this podcast possible, and that is Stratton Seed Company. You know, we've been working with them several years. We got a lot of seed. We helped develop several seed blends. Excited to get some more seed in the ground this spring. It seems like there's a lot more people.
There's a lot of buzz around the word Stratton seed right now. Which
yes,
is cool.
There is.
It's cool to see them grow and take off by having a good product and treating people right. So,
for sure.
A good product priced really, really well, too. I don't know if it can be beat or matched.
And that's one of the big reasons why we work with them. Great product, great pricing.
Dude, we might clarify some things today on the podcast.
No, I sure
saying.
Hope so. I sure hope so. It's kind of one of those that I don't think people... This is the first podcast we've sat down. We did one more that hasn't released yet, but this is the first podcast we've sat down, just you and I, in a
Since
month.
February.
Maybe.
12th.
And so...
At NWTF, when we knocked out a bunch.
Yeah. And so this is kind of getting back to it, but this is one of those that you may want to flag... Mark, remind yourself to listen to at the end of your hot part of deer season next fall as you get ready to move into timber management, habitat improvement during that dormant season, because this podcast will hopefully clear up an absolute pile of questions that we get, an absolute pile of confusion. Comments we see. There's
misunderstandings, confusions, fears, not knowing what the future is going to hold with these things. Like
short-term management plans.
Yeah, we want to paint a
one-track mind management plans.
A very clear picture of why you need to be working in the timber. Like why you need to address those
and
areas.
How.
And exactly. And how. And if you use this technique, what is it going to look like? Because, Adam, how many properties have you been to here, let's just say since January recently, that were dominated, like the dominated portion of the acres were timber?
It's definitely over 75%.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. 80-ish percent is
most people
timber.
Would find that. I think this would be true, that if it is open, there's a very small acres in the United States that is open acres that are devoted to recreational land.
Yeah.
Usually they're devoted to crops, cattle,
land use,
something
of making a dollar.
Yeah.
But here's a simple question though. Let's pose this to everyone listening. If you were a recreational landowner and let's just say you bought a property and you had 100 acres, 80 of it were open, and the other guy next to you, or you had the option of buying 80 acres that was, I mean, excuse me, 100 acres that was timber, dominated by timber, would you take that open acres and only like manage the 20 acres of timber? Like would you completely forget about the open 80 acres? But like it seems as if people take the open acres on their timber ground and only focus on that. But let's flip that and do the inverse. Like if you had 80 acres of open ground on your 100 acres that you just purchased, would you leave all of it alone? Like would you not do anything? Because that's essentially what's happening for most property owners.
Okay, I get what you're saying. Yeah. It's like
a horrible job of explaining that.
It basically is whatever ratio of open acres to timber acres are always, not always, I shouldn't say that, but most of the time, they're almost always neglected as if, okay, I got my timber, that's where the wildlife go, that's good. Now let's manage these open acres.
Yeah, but like if you had that same ratio of open acres, would you just not manage those too?
Yeah.
Like what's the hang up? What's the deal?
I think we could be honest and say that regardless of most of the acres we tour, whether they're open or timbered, all of them need better management for the most part.
Well,
but I will say that timber seems to be the growing trend of the most neglected acres. Regardless of what state we're in, they're always the most neglected.
Yes.
And even if it's pine plantation, which is highly managed, but it's managed in a much longer scale than our short-term food plots, disking, whatever, old field management. Now, I think there's a reason this podcast is coming, and we're kind of on the tail end of it. And there's probably a reason because we just endured months of bad information.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to clear the air, if you will, and try to clear up some stuff on really what we're seeing and how we should be trying to get just a little bit further in our education.
Yeah.
Is the simple fact that the timber management. So we've already established that there's a whole bunch of timber across the country that's recreational ground devoted to whitetail deer, devoted to wildlife, that's not being managed.
Correct.
But some of the work that people are diving into the timber, they're trying to focus on one thing or doing it some certain way that is like, you're missing the boat just enough. Like, I'm pumped that you're going into the timber, but you could do so much more if you knew exactly what you were getting yourself into.
It's like going from like sitting on the bench, like you've played the whole season and you've sat on the bench, and then you get in the game and you're like afraid to take a shot, right? You're not going to score. Yeah. You're not going to win the game.
Well, some
if you're not doing it right.
Some of the management I'm seeing, they're shooting in the wrong end. They're scoring for the other team.
Oh, dang it! Well, yeah. But and the whole point of the podcast is we're not at all in any way, shape, or form pointing fingers, calling anybody out. The point of the podcast is to simply educate people on what's going to happen, how these different techniques result in different things on the landscape. And if you have this goal, then you need to do this technique and apply it in at this intensity. If you try and go and do it at a, let's say, a half portion, you're not going to get the response that you want. Like, you can't go in and say, oh, well, I know I was, I'm supposed to be doing it at like a clear cut, but I'm going to cut 50% of the trees.
Yeah.
That's not going to get you that result that you really, truly want. Like,
now,
you can't.
Exactly. But this is like pre-show, I guess, the conversation we had today at lunch was the unfortunate side of that is that timber is so neglected across the country. If you could pull out and say, you know, 70%, 80%, I don't know the number. I don't know if anybody knows the number, but God, is how much of this timber is neglected in closed canopy and almost no understory.
Yeah.
It's a large ton. Majority. So when they do that 50% and they try to improve it and they don't, and they miss the boat, if you will, they still get enough of a reaction or enough of a regeneration that they think, wow, that was incredible. Look at what. But once you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly.
And
you don't know how good that response can be.
Yeah. And if you don't know how great it can be, you may be stuck thinking that what you did was incredible, when in reality, you could have so much more.
You could have doubled the impact. It's like it's like going into a test and feeling like, I'm going to fail this. Coming out with a D and being like, whew, skated by, I got past it, I'm moving on, that was great. But then you're like, if I had just studied, I could have gotten an A. I could have knocked this thing out of the park. You can do so much better, but like,
or read the instructions, realize it was an open book test.
Yeah, that too. But it's like the habitat quality is poor enough where when we do things, when we do manage to some degree, we see that response, which is that encouragement to keep going. But we don't want to stop there. We're hungry. We're greedy. And truthfully, the habitat and the landscape is telling us that it needs it. When we go and we evaluate a property, or we go and we walk a timber stand, you know, we're seeing things that the canopies are starting to die out. They're out competing each other.
Yep.
You have dead trees standing everywhere, and you have and densely stocked timber because of poor management practices previously.
Yep.
So it's like, if you know how to read the environment, it's screaming at you that I'm unhealthy, I'm not doing well, and then the habitat is then therefore suffering too. So we have to be able to go in.
Not just the habitat, but the wildlife as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And a lot of times,
by default,
it's the wildlife that we don't often manage for, because like white-tailed deer are so adaptive that they're going to be fine, they're going to be surviving, probably not thriving, but at the same time, some of our really key species, really important species, may do awful,
like,
in that closed canopy or completely non-existent.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just is this ongoing, I guess, continued education that this podcast will be here for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Because habitat is so bad across the country.
Yeah.
And there's so many bad recommendations, bad plans, or just lack of, I think we're all guilty of this, lack of knowledge of what really it could turn into.
Yeah,
if
definitely.
We get behind and do it the right way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we start jumping into this, though, we need to send out the reminder that, guys, we launched it, kind of a soft launch, and we've been so doggone busy with on-site consults that we haven't message or preach it a whole lot, but we do have our virtual property valuations where you can chat with us for an hour, 2 hours, however long you want to do, over the phone in a online meeting.
Virtual screen share meeting.
Yeah, so we're going to be going over maps, photos, references, things like that, so you can get a very good idea of what to do or a good direction of what you need to do on your farm. And so we're doing that. They can check it out at landandlegacy.tv. Check on, click on the consulting tab, and you'll find it probably at the bottom of the page. Another thing, if you guys are considering real estate, Matt, chat on that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got some awesome opportunities to be able to work with people trying to find and identify a recreational property that's going to meet their goals of the land ownership. So we can work with you on your behalf to identify those properties and then come in at the end of the purchasing opportunity of that property and do consultation services for you too. So let's not waste time on trying to find just a general property that's not going to meet your goals. Let's find the right property that's going to set you up for success on the front end. That's certainly important. We want to basically expedite the success on property. So buying right, buying the property that's going to get you there is certainly important. We are happy to do that. Reach out through the real estate consulting tab there as well on the website, www.landandlegacy.tv.
Last thing before we jump in, we've got QDMA Whitetail Weekend coming up this weekend. So you're listening to this podcast on March the 10th. We're going to be headed to Georgia, Lord willing.
Yes.
Coronavirus doesn't spread like crazy. But we'll be headed down there. So if you guys are listening to this on March 10th, 11th, or probably just those 2 days, you can...
You better get to Athens by Friday, Saturday, because we're going to be down there doing some presentations, some seminars. And it's going to be a fun week. It's always great to hang out with those guys and the crowd that comes to those events. They're fantastic.
For sure. We've got a presentation on saddle hunting. We've got a presentation on... increasing habitat usable space for white-tailed deer. And then also we're both, I think, going to be on the habitat panel.
Yep.
So we're going to be kind of busy guys down there.
But exciting event. Hopefully you guys can definitely meet us down there. Or if you can't, put it on your calendar for next year. That's a heck of a time. Getting back into this thing, you know, when you have a closed canopy system and we're looking just at whitetail deer, the production levels of 1 acre over a given year's time frame, we're just looking at the food value, because if it's closed canopy timber, we know by default, okay, cover is going to be really limited, right? Yeah. So
cover, food,
yeah,
cover, food, security.
All of it
down
the tank. But annually,
should we say something before we start kind of really going into this? If you were to score closed canopy forest on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as goals for whitetail deer, outside of few acres or spots on northerly slopes for thermal cover in the summer, outside of that,
slopes or drainage, you know, wooded drainages,
I would consider it a 1 or a 2.
Yeah.
It's way down there. It's like way at the bottom of the list of what we're going for.
Yeah, definitely. No, I was going to give it a 2. Just based on the overall acorn production. That's saying that maybe you have acorn producing trees in that timber. Not all closed canopy timber has that.
No.
Or has very, very few. So typically speaking, okay, we know that it's not a need, it's not a necessity when it comes to the life cycle, the portion of habitat composition needs to be closed canopy timber is very, very small for deer to thrive and not just survive, but it's producing 50 to 100 pounds of food per acre annually, and there's no cover value when it comes to security aspects of that timber. We still see, yes, deer making a
living
in that.
Where else are they
going to
be?
Yeah, like we still see deer doing that, but that doesn't mean that is good quality habitat. And that certainly does not mean that it does not have room for improvement. And that's the point that we're trying to make and drive home, that it has a small purpose, but that window is very tiny. But we need to manage the timber.
It's like the window for closed canopy timber and what when they're going to actually need that specifically is just like when they're going to need that dark, dense thermal cover for late winter. Like, for example, Eastern red cedar thickets, where people are really trying to monitor and get those on their property for winter thermal cover. It's like that window of time when they're going to need that is very small. Flip that, the window of time when they're going to need closed canopy forest for thermal regulation in the summer is very small.
You know what? You know how much people like know that we hate eastern red cedar monocultures? I'm going to specify monoculture. You know how people like hate that?
Yeah.
I bet they don't know how much we despise unmanaged timber, though, too.
I don't know if they know how much we despise invasive species either.
They're going to find out today, though.
Yeah.
Check out the other podcast. But
what number are we on? We're on probably like 212, I think, so on Sportsman's Nation. So check out number 1 through 211 in here.
But you know, it's certainly
and we
important.
Need to say something too, because there's that kind of theory that to grow timber, to grow profitable logs, you have to have, you know, you're just letting it cook, if you will. You're right. Just letting your timber grow because we're going to be logging it. You could walk 20 yards into that timber and find weed trees that need to go.
Oh, absolutely. And when you say weed tree, let's slow down and define that real quick, because someone's like, wait, what?
You got to. So
if you're throwing too many things at me right there.
So let's put it
sense?
In terms of something that anybody could or that would be easier to understand. So if we're looking at crops, let's just say with corn or soybeans, you've got your actual financial tree or plant there, the plant that's going to make
cash
you
a
financial gain. So you've got your cash crop. And that's in the crop setting. So you've got corn, soybeans. Well, in timber, we're looking at species that are going to be a cash crop as well. It could be oaks. It could be walnuts.
Cherry.
It could be cherry. It could even be tulip poplar, depending on where we're at in the market. We're trying to find the most profitable species as possible. And that's not just any oak or any walnut. That's the ones that actually have a trunk that provides financial gains. And so
the right shape.
If you're looking at, go back to the corn soybeans, it may be, it could be ragweed, could be pigweed, it could be Meyerstail, it could be, you know, sunflower, it could be even a volunteer corn in a soybean field.
Yeah.
Or sedan grass. It could be any plant in an unwanted place. And that's your definition of a weed. So in a timber stand, a weed tree is the same thing, a tree in an unwanted place. So it could be softwood trees. It could be invasive species. It could be a misshaped oak. It could be a stressed oak.
It's a generic term to identify a tree that's growing somewhere that's probably impacting, let's say, the tree that is going to provide value. And value could be from a log standpoint, from a monetary gain, or from a value standpoint of food production, whether it's a hard mass tree or a soft mass tree.
Or overall just adding diversity to the forest.
Sure, sure.
And so
that's our definition of a weed tree.
Yeah. And so basically, I look at it from a standpoint of, okay, what category does it fall into? Financial gain? Okay. Financial gain and acorn production can be kind of similar in that standpoint from an oak stand, from an oak tree. Now, if I'm looking at it the other category, I'm going, okay, weed trees. If it's a 50-foot elm, or a maple, or a
dogwood,
or anything.
Hop hornbeam, or
any of those.
Yeah. Tulip poplar, whatever.
Dang impressive for it to be a 50-foot dogwood, or American hornbeam, or hop hornbeam. But at the same time, if it's any of that category, I look at it and go, I can make this really great deer food and other species food, or open canopy, so I have more herbaceous plants and grasses growing underneath.
Here's what's funny.
It's it has like, no purpose being that tall.
Yeah, absolutely. It's out of reach, so there needs to
especially
be the
now for you guys that are like, whoa, so any elm I'm going to cut? Well, sometimes I'm going to let good ones grow because
We don't hate forests.
I love diversity, but at the same time, if there's 50 of them in 1 acre, I need to thin that stand of them.
Absolutely. And so, and it's all based around, let's say, whatever the goal is of that certain given area, what you're trying to achieve will help define that weed tree definition. But there is value, or there is value, let's say, in trees being cut for wildlife. It's okay, like we can free up an oak tree, we can do the crop tree release so it produces more mast, but then all the trees and stumps that we cut around it, now that's providing additional benefit and further value to you can achieve everything that you want by going in and cutting trees around mass producing or good quality stand timber trees. Like, there's a lot of overlap here, basically.
Yeah. So my goals, so people can understand where I come at it from a standpoint of my family farm. What is my goal in managing my forest? I want to increase financial gains. So I want to harvest timber for profit. So I'm managing for the potential harvest or the next harvest. I'm managing for diversity, and I'm managing for a healthy forest. Not only for the forest itself, the trees, but for all native wildlife species.
So that must then mean that there is not only just big, tall trees, but there's varying stages of
Absolutely.
Tree growth. For a healthy forest to operate, it has to have the age structure within forest stands or a given property for that to be able to occur.
Yep.
So that means that cutting is actively happening to achieve all of those said goals. It's not just a stand back and watch and let just the survival of the fittest, you know, pick themselves within a stand of trees.
You're thinning weed trees like you're pulling weeds in a garden.
That's all it is. But you're just doing it mechanically with a chainsaw. Yep. We'll get into those techniques or whatever later on. But you're just making that decision. And to me, a lot of times what you're doing is you're just speeding up the inevitable. Like, if you have an overstock density forest, too many stems per acre in a given unit, they're going to die out. Like, they can't all live.
Nature
just won't allow
it. Yes.
They're going to weed themselves out.
Take it
20 years down the road.
Run down to your local wherever store and buy 6 trees. And go take some of those trees, take 3 of them and stick them in your yard, and then take the other 3 and stick them in the understory of a closed canopy woodlot and see how quickly they grow. And
you know
difference.
What they would tell you? You know what they would tell you? Well, that's not going to work, Adam. Well, then why are we letting it work in the timber right now? Why are we not going out there and freeing up some trees? why are we just letting it do its thing? Because its thing has probably been mismanaged in the past prior to you owning that property that's allowing it to get to this stage. So we need to go in, intercede, and say, okay, I know that in 5 years, or I can predict, let's say, by evaluating the tree health, the canopy, the species that are there, I can predict that that tree there is not going to make it. It's going to be dead in 5 years.
Yeah.
So I'm going to choose to cut that tree. If it's going to be dead in 5 years, it's not going to provide me anything. I might be able to reset that vegetation, bring it back down to a deer's level, but then I'm also freeing up the canopy for the tree that's next to it or the 3 other trees around it that are going to be productive and get me closer to a goal.
Two of the biggest lies, indirect lies, that we've heard in the last 100 years.
From managing natural resources.
These are the two biggest indirect, I want to be very clear, indirect lies.
Because we've heard a lot of indirect lies. In our
because when somebody tells you this, we're going to go ahead and paraphrase and assume that it means blanket statement A.
Okay.
Smokey the Bear tells us only you can prevent forest fires. So over time, we believe that forest fires are bad. Well, wild land raging fires and a 7% relative humidity out west burning out treetops 50 foot tall. Yes, that's bad from a standpoint of it's pretty catastrophic. At the same time, that's a whole nother podcast. But basically, that tells us that's bad. Okay. But not all prescribed fire or fire on the landscape is bad. But therefore, society here is Smokey the Bear saying only you can prevent forest fires. And we think, whoa, fire's bad. That's one lie that we fell victim to. The other one is that to save the environment, we're going to have to plant trees.
Oh, yeah, or that logging is bad.
Yes. And so save the environment. And there's campaigns happening right now where you buy something and to save the environment, they're going to plant a tree somewhere in the rainforest or somewhere. Yeah. And yes, sure, it's great that we have trees going in the ground and it's not all cutting trees. But at the same time, there's a whole lot of forests across the globe
begging to get cut.
That need thinning.
Yes.
They need to be
actively
released.
Managed.
And it's happening right in front of our eyes. We have yep. overstocked forests across the country that
yeah.
are doing nothing but raising ticks.
You know, them tick first.
Yeah.
Well, and here's the other thing too, from guys who like to cut trees. How many times when you really start to sink a saw into stuff, are you finding out that they're hollow?
Like
when
all
you start
the time.
To cut a bunch, it's like, I guarantee this one's going to be hollow. And then you get halfway through and your saw zips.
You know,
like,
the worst
wow.
part is when you sink a saw into a giant tree and you find out it's hollow.
Yeah.
I get real nervous real fast. It's
exactly.
like, oh, crap. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm not screwing
get out
this
from
up.
Underneath this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
usually
yeah.
a big tree like that, though, you find out in the first face cut. But
yeah.
at the same time, I did one in Illinois last week where it was like a good 8-inch tree. It was mm-hmm. leaning really good. And I thought, okay, and it was like, uh-oh, this thing's
yep.
hollow. Thankfully,
oh, yeah.
it's leaning hard. But, you know, and that's something, too, that I guess as we jump into starting to cut trees now, we know that we need to thin the forest. We need to remove the weed trees. We need to actively engage. And, fellas, this podcast is driven off a real-world experience. This
yeah.
stuff isn't taught. It's not learnt in a classroom.
A-R-N-T. Learned.
It's not learned
it's real
in
world.
A or taught in a, most university college or most universities or colleges of managing timber for wildlife. Like there's forestry and there's wildlife ecology or wildlife management. But a lot of the small universities aren't teaching this. And this podcast is not that Matt and I set through a college course and got this degree. This is
I have a degree in biology and a concentration in wildlife management, and I did not go to a course that talked about managing woodlots and timber for wildlife.
Yeah, it doesn't happen a lot. There's only a select universities.
Truthfully, if we're being serious with ourselves, it's common sense.
It is.
It is 100% common sense when we know what each individual tree does and then what it doesn't do. We can say, oh, well, yeah, that's not going to have benefit for this species that I'm trying to manage for. Therefore, I might need to cut it. Or maybe I just need to take a general dendrology or the study of trees to be able to identify healthy trees.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Take wildlife out of the equation for a quick second.
Yeah, we're thinking on the same path because
like,
this is my next little spill.
Just walk into the timber. You can see stress in almost every single, I wouldn't say every single tree, but you can walk within a 5-acre unit and see like every type of stress pretty much out there. See stress in the canopy, see stress in the base, see stress in the bark, see some disease. You can just learn about trees and learn how to identify it, and you'll find out very quickly when you begin
to
walk
the structure
evaluate.
Of growth.
Yeah.
Is this tree that appears to be healthy, is it growing crooked and twisted, and then at the last 20 foot it takes a 90 and goes up through a hole in the
yeah.
in the canopy because that's the only way that tree,
and it's
only
occupying,
way that tree could grow
it,
and
like,
survive.
It has like a tiny, tiny canopy.
Yeah.
Like it's like a ice cream cone or something like that. It's just barely sticking up, but like everything else below is just trying to survive. Like it's suffering. It's like stifled.
Yeah. It's a crying shame. But here's if you want to be a phenomenal. If you take pride in being a deer manager, here's what you can do to be a really good deer manager. And this goes with any game species or anybody that owns land. If you want to manage that farm, that acreage, the very best you can, this is where you should start. Learn what species are growing.
Yeah.
It's going to be impossible, and none of this amounts to a hill of beans if you can't learn the species that are on your property.
Yes.
I wish I could.
Back,
maybe
it's like back, back I to want the to
say
basic.
This, but you're going to cringe a little bit probably. But if you don't know what species are there, don't give advice to anyone else on how to manage it.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know what species are there, you don't. You shouldn't.
You can't give
you
advice.
You shouldn't give advice, and you shouldn't even begin to fire up a chainsaw because we don't know if you're doing good things or bad things.
That, and that's because like every tree has a role, and it will play a purpose. It just, when you sink a saw into that tree or you choose to not sink a saw into that tree, you're dictating what that role is, whether it's good or whether it's bad.
Yeah.
You're the one who says what's going to happen, but if you can't identify the tree and you don't know what role it plays for the goal, then you shouldn't be doing it.
So maybe basic, this is good timing for this podcast. We're telling you what to do so you can spend all spring and summer IDing those trees, because it's a whole lot easier to ID trees through the growing season than it is dormant season. But IDing those trees, and I don't even care if you go out with red paint and paint all the oaks.
Yeah.
At least just categorize the oaks, and then we'll go into red oak, black oak, and
we're
going
to go into some forests next year, next consultancy, just a rainbow. Well, that's my green elms. That's my red oak.
I'm just picturing red at the top of the trunk, head high, and then it turns into pink as they start IDing the fact that it's an oak. Now it's a red oak. Now it's actually a black. It's in the
black
it's,
oak. Yeah,
it's a black oak. Okay. And it's like, what's the three different colors? Oh, I had to categorize.
Or someone messes up and they can't erase it, so they just spray something over top of like white start over.
Yeah. So ID your trees and start to learn what they are. And then the next step is to learn what category it falls into of, is this a tree that's going to make me money later on to where I might be able to buy more equipment or, heck, more acreage, depending on what species it is. And therefore, we should say that my goal is to maximize the profits of my farm. And I can grow pretty darn good deer in the process of that.
And if you don't know how to do that, that's okay. But figure out, work with someone who can teach you that. Wink, wink, nod, nod.
Yeah.
But make sure you take those steps ahead of time. And maybe you're already there. Maybe you can identify all these trees. That's great. But maybe then you're at the point where we're getting into of, okay, I know what all these trees are, but how do I execute wise use of these resources? Because I have heard over time so many different things and so many just like absolute statements of, this is the way to do it. No, this is the way to do it. And then you hear someone else say something completely different that contradicts all the other things that you've heard about how to go about managing timber.
Yeah.
And it's like, and I've had this conversation, I know you have too, Adam, with people. And it's like, I know that I need to do it. I know that I need to get into the timber acres on the property and manage them. But I'm so confused on how to do it that I'm scared to do it because I don't know if I'm going to therefore then do it wrong. And that's not a cool place to be. We need
analysis paralysis.
Yeah, we need good information.
Two schools of thought. No, not really. There's the, I don't know anything, so I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah.
Or I've consumed too much information and it all contradicts itself.
Yeah.
And now I don't want to do anything.
Yeah.
Because I'm scared.
Yeah.
I know I need to do something, but this tell me to do it this way, and all this other stuff tells me to do it that way, and I don't know what.
And yeah, so then which one do I do?
Yeah.
And what you're probably going to find out is maybe it's a combination of everything, but
exactly.
But let's get there.
Exactly.
But let's get there.
Yeah. So first, let's learn some species.
Yep.
Let's learn if it's good, bad, what category it falls into. Is it going to make me money, or should I designate this to wildlife habitat?
Wildlife benefit.
Because lo and behold, the stuff that's really great for timber value that's going to make us money can produce a crop of acorns or nuts that's going to be beneficial to wildlife.
Sure.
But then there's other species that may not produce a...
Have a lower timber value.
Lower timber value, but higher browse value.
And that's where it's like this model of can you have maximum forestry production and maximum wildlife? Maybe not. But can you have a great mixture of both? Absolutely, you can. And this is where the rubber meets the road, is identifying the species that are going to give you the max benefit for both.
Well, that kind of goes with
benefit for both. Let me say
in the timber, but flipping to open landscape, can you maximize cattle production and maximize wildlife production? No. But can you have really good cattle production and really good wildlife?
You better believe it.
And that's the way I want to be.
Yeah.
That's a whole other podcast of not maximizing one category, but overall you're maximizing the entire category.
Wise use of natural resources, yeah, which is what we're trying to talk about and share.
So, man, this one is just like
we could go off in
months,
this route.
So it's a 3-hour podcast. Hang on tight.
Yeah.
Gosh, it's just like, okay, I'm learning these species. Now I know what I want
to
do.
Well, now I can walk up to that tree and say, this is what it is.
Yeah. At least this is an oak, and it looks like it's got a great canopy. I mean, it looks big, majestic. It's a straight log. There's not a whole lot of limbs at the bottom. That one might make me some income one day. Mm-hmm. I'm going to leave it. But right next to it is a white oak, and I always heard white oaks were great, but he's all twisted and gnarly.
You better leave it, too.
You better leave it, too. Even though he's twisted and gnarly, well, he's still a white oak. I know he's good.
Or maybe I've got three straight trees growing close, three white oaks that are growing real close to each other. It's like, I'm cutting. Some of you guys are getting sacrificed. Like,
yeah.
I'm probably going to cut one or two of you, just depending on what the area, what else is there. But it's like,
what's
having
best
close
for
density,
the species is not always what's best for the individual.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that, I think of like prescribed fire, where mm-hmm. people are worried about burning up nests. Well, we may have to lose one nest every 3 years.
But
to,
I know all the other nests that
all
that
the other nests
are going to come into this area and be super beneficial.
Yeah.
And so that's the same thing. I might have to sacrifice trees. Well, it just goes to the research that Dr. Craig Harper and his guys have put out, and he's done some podcasts on, is, okay, I've got 70% of the white oak trees. I got 40% of the white oak trees producing 70% of the acorns. I can sacrifice some white oaks, and I'm not interfering with the overall production of, or I'm not losing production out of the white oak hard mast in my timber.
In fact, a lot of times I'm gaining
more.
You're
gaining it. Exactly.
Yeah. That's like, one of the biggest things. Well, I guess there's a lot of fears of cutting timber. It's going to be messy. It's going to grow up in brush. Another one is, I'm going to lose my acorn production.
You're darn right, it's growing up.
Yeah, brush.
Heck,
the word
yeah.
that, that's right up next to predators.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, like to me, there's just so many fears that go involved with timber management. But our biggest fear is what they're doing, is not doing anything.
Yeah.
That's like the biggest fear is like, could you imagine if we all went out and did nothing on our timber?
Like,
the wildlife would struggle.
Take your hands and then just put them on your seat and then just sit on them.
Yeah.
Like, that's
yeah.
the scary part. That's not an answer. Being idle is not an answer to
or
it. So,
those
know.
Hands are in the 1 acre food plot yeah. all season.
Yeah. Yeah. And neglecting the actual timber portion. Because I mean, as... And this doesn't go for all the timbered acres.
I got a shirt for you, or some kind of meme is oh man, I might offend some of you with this one, so I'm sorry. But a deer guy's fingers he's got dirt under his fingernails because he's out in the food plot like crazy.
Yep.
And he thinks he's doing awesome stuff, but a land manager's got calluses on his hands because he's running a chainsaw
yep.
most of the months out of the year. And that's who I want you to have calluses.
Yeah.
Because that's when we know where you're running a saw, you're doing stuff that's really meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. Or you're doing stuff like maybe your food plots they're fine. Like they can grow, they can have some weeds in them. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's deer food.
Yeah.
But there's some areas and some portions of timber that where we've gone to and we've evaluated just like given acres and there has been no trees worth saving.
No.
But at the same time frame, there's been people who we've walked that timber with who have said, isn't this gorgeous or isn't this awesome? And it's like, No. No, it's not.
By what terms are we talking?
Yeah, yeah. From yeah. what standpoint or what perspective are we talking? Because you told me your goals were X, but this is going completely against that. Like,
yeah.
we're not getting anywhere. This is taking steps back. So, like, we got to really, really manage intensely in here. And it's going to take work, but I know that that work is going to result in benefit. So we just got to attack it aggressively. But let's go into kind of our scenario of,
yeah.
okay, now we've set the stage for, guys, I get it. Timber management is important. I don't need to be scared of doing it. But take me to what are the techniques and how do I implement these techniques? Is one superior to another? What do I do? How do I execute now that I know that it's important? So we got a scenario. Kind of walk us through that, Adam.
So it's basically we're taking a 20-acre woodlot. Of course, this could be in many, many states. But it's a mix of species. We've got maples. We've got oaks. We've got elms. We've got cedars, eastern red cedars specifically. Matt doesn't have that, but I'm going to make that on there on the notes.
Because there's multiple types of cedars.
Yeah,
white
that's
cedar
one of the biggest,
and eastern red cedar, completely different.
We got dogwoods. So we'll go with flowering dogwoods and gray dogwoods. We've got hickories. Let's even throw some, because we've got varying slopes and elevation, we'll throw in some eastern ironwood, musselwood in
okay.
there. Or any of the hornbeams, same thing. So we're going with those. But so our goals is we want to improve bedding cover in certain units and overall production and health of the forest while increasing browse and herbaceous cover. Here's what it would look like with each technique.
And so the techniques here's the can, if you can start hearing it begin to open that. And these are the things that always get debated.
I don't think it's a can. I think it's a drum.
It's a drum. It's a 55-gallon drum this week that we're opening. but it is hinge cutting.
Yep.
Versus
popular one.
Yep. Versus hack and squirt versus just flush cutting. Those are basically in what we see.
Or girdle and spray.
Yeah, or girdle and spray.
Similar to hack and squirt, but
right.
a little bit different technique.
But same result, let's say.
Yep.
But basically, those are like the 3 to 4 most popular techniques that everyone's just questioning.
Yep.
What do we do? I don't know what's best. I've heard this. I've heard that. But we're just going to go through and say, okay, here's the scenario. Let's talk about the pros and the cons of if we just did this technique, and then if we just did X technique, then we just did the bottom one. So
yeah.
let's walk through that, be as detailed as we can, paint the picture of what that's going to look like from an implementing, and then 5 years down the road, what that's going to look like.
Yep, and I want to address the fact that we use all of those tools.
Yeah.
Like each one of those, it's not the tool, it's a tool. Each one of these four is a tool in a tool bag to manage a forest, but it should not be your only tool.
Like, and I think we've made this and I got it later on in the notes, but basically you're not going to go and build a house, or let's just say you had saws, all like just different types of saws.
You hired a general contractor to come build your home,
and all
shows
he brings up
is a hammer and a saw.
Well,
he's fired.
I'm just thinking that all he brings up is a sawzall. Like that's
okay.
all he's got. He goes,
yeah.
"I'm gonna cut everything I need to with this sawzall." And it's like, whoa!
But are you
bro.
Gonna use the handle as a hammer?
Yeah, but then his other options are table saw, skill saw, and a miter box. Like there's a bunch of different ways in every single thing.
And a chainsaw.
Yeah. But it's like if that's all that you're taking to the woods out of a toolbox, then you're handcuffing yourself and not making that home as good as it can be, or not managing that habitat or that natural resource
yeah.
as good as it can be if you're only selecting one tool to use.
You might get that house built, but in 1 year it's going to fall down.
Or it's going to need to be braced up real bad.
Yeah. Or in many instances, the guy that's building that home ain't the one living there.
Yeah,
anyway.
No doubt.
And his tools show it.
Yes, exactly. So let's just start with hinge cutting. So,
yeah.
So we've got
because
this.
It's most popular. Is that
sure.
why it's at the top?
Sure.
Hinge cutting.
We're gonna get to all of them. So.
Yeah. Hinge cutting is definitely. I mean, we use this one probably more than most of you guys would believe, but we do use it. now. We don't use it as a one-stop shop, fix the habitat, fix all your woods. It's not like, oh, it's timber lot. It's time to hinge cut. It's not like that, but we still use it.
Yeah, and the pros for utilizing a hinge cut is basically immediate cover and food on the ground.
Yep.
And you have different
instant
heights.
Instant food, instant cover.
Of cover. You know, it's not laying flat against the ground.
Yeah.
There is some height, vertical structure. Yeah, that's cool and that's great. But imagine a 20-acre woodlot, or imagine just 1 acre where every tree species was hinge cut.
Yeah. We talk a lot about usable space, and Kyle and Frank bring that over from the upland side.
Yes.
But in a whitetail world, usable space to where each acre, each square foot can be utilized by whitetail deer.
Yeah.
If you take that 20-acre lot and you go in and you take 1 acre and you hinge cut everything, and for visual purposes, we're going to say hinge cut at 2 foot, 2.5 foot off the ground.
Yep.
Knee to hip height, which is a commonplace. We'll touch on the high hinge cuts in a second. If you did that and you hinge cut every tree in a typical forest where there are scattered trees and understory, you're creating a tremendous thicket, okay? Not by terms of tremendous is beneficial, but a phenomenal, what's that game, pickup sticks? Where it was like you dump them out and you're trying to pull out the stick. You're creating that to where the interior of that 1 acre most likely isn't getting used as greatly as the exterior. Because it's darn near impossible for a deer to penetrate through all that.
And basically, you took an entire acre and exercised and used all your energy to cut an entire acre, but you really only got the benefit of a quarter to a half acre out
the
of
perimeter.
Entire acre.
You got the perimeter.
So it's like, well, that was stupid. Like I cut and spent the entire time to cut the acre, but I'm really only getting benefit from the outside edges.
Yeah.
That's not as wise as it could be. And we've probably mismanaged the species that were growing within that 1 acre unit that fell within our 20-acre wood block.
And what you did was you just brought that canopy that was, let's say, 30 foot, and you brought it down to 5 foot.
Because we haven't used herbicide yet.
We didn't use herbicide. So
we've
all
got
that
more food happening.
A pro of hinge cut is the fact that it stays living for several years, which is... On most species, you get in most cuts, if done correctly. But you get immediate food and immediate cover, and as well as cover into the future and food into the future.
Yep.
Now, one of the cons or some of the cons with hinge cutting is that it's messy. It's unnavigable. Ooh,
yep.
Really fat tongue that one. It's dangerous, especially if you're doing big trees. Lord have mercy. Some of the videos you see in the world of hinge cutting.
I'm literally like, his head's going to come off.
Yeah, like I'm watching a man die right now.
Yeah.
And then some species can't be hinged. So some people want to hinge cut certain species, and all of a sudden they realize that they can't do it. They can't handle it, but they don't realize that it's going to die anyway.
Well, it's going to die, or it's just literally, it's very, very dangerous to be doing that because it's a very hard, dense, fibrous wood, and it's going to cause barber tearing. It's not safe. So what we established basically was, okay, there's some pros there.
Yeah.
There's some advantages, probably for certain species, but it doesn't really make sense to do the entire thing. So, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Now, let's discuss something as well. When you bring that canopy down to 5 foot, 5 years from now, if you hinge cut everything, you're going to have a whole bunch of...
Your closed canopy again.
Your closed canopy, but it's only 10 foot off the ground.
Yeah.
And so you'll get that immediate flush of some of your herbaceous plants and grasses, and you'll even, what you'll get more of is brambles.
Yeah.
You'll have raspberry, multifloral rose, gooseberry, even coralberry, which isn't a bramble, or buckbrush, some people call it. That's all going to come up if that's
partial
in the seed
shade.
Yeah, you've got these semi-shade tolerant species that are going to benefit, and so you get that flush, and you may be fooled thinking that, wow, we did some good, but we didn't get
that's
the
not desirable
stuff that we're
forage.
Looking for.
That's
yeah.
not desirable forage. It's additional cover, but really, 5 more
it
years
could
after
so
that,
much better.
It could be so, so much better, but 5 years after that, how do you maintain those sprouts? above that are already at 5 foot level when you cut it, and then it's like now it's way out of reach. Like, what do you do?
Yeah.
What do you? What? What's the next?
I sure to the heck wouldn't crawl back in there with a chainsaw.
Heck no. There's no way I'm doing it. So, yeah. But that's the thing of like, I got to think. I can't think short term and think just food cover everywhere right here. I've got to think down the road. Is this the best use of the area and the wise management of the resources growing here? Because
and fire won't I touch those species. And
yeah.
I mean, it would if it was a tremendous fire, but we don't want to send any of those in there.
You're taking a really, really big, dense bark tree, most likely at the base, that's already well established fire. It's not going to kill that thing.
And at the same time, it's still living. It's still
right.
sending nutrients. Right. So it's going to take a heck of a fire to kill it.
Hellacious fire. Like, it's not happening.
Yeah. And
so now, but then you're sitting again on your hands saying, well, I just messed up. Like, I can't do anything now.
Done messed up, A.A. Ron.
Yeah. I can't do anything now. And it's 5 years later, and I've got closed canopy again.
Yeah.
So I was like, ugh.
Bring in the dozer.
Yeah.
Start over.
About it.
And so that's what happens when you do your normal 2 to 4 foot hinge cut.
Yeah.
If you did higher ones just real quick, it's just a faster pace regeneration that turns into closed canopy at 10 to 15 foot high. And you don't get the benefit of the herbaceous plants and grasses almost at all because the high hinge cuts. So high hinge cuts are not something we do unless it's like trying to really screen eyeballs from a road. And even then we try to avoid them.
If we will implement it on the species that we'll discuss, it's going to be about knee to mid thigh level.
Yeah, and absolutely.
It. And size wise too, I'm probably not going to hinge anything over 6 inch diameter. Yeah. Like, it's just not. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, when you find out...
I ain't done it.
When you start to try and hinge everything, that tree does not fall with, let's say, intensity to the ground. Like, when you flush cut it and there's nothing holding that tree, like the actual hinge, gracefully placing it on top of other canopies, like, it doesn't just fall, right?
Yeah.
You get everything hung up. Everything wants to hang up, and it's just not safe anymore. So then you got to drop a big monster tree, and it's like a big old domino game. That just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Doesn't work.
No. So avoid the high hinge cuts.
Yeah.
Pretty much always, and then don't get carried away with the hinge cuts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's one scenario.
Yep. Now, what happens if we go in and we flush cut everything? Yeah. Let's talk about the pros and the cons of that.
You know, flush cutting, we're basically cutting a tree less than 2 foot high all the way through. Top falls over, and we're left with a stump.
You have a long regeneration
depending on depending on the species, depending on the size, and also kind of depending on the time of the year when you cut it. That depicts on what kind of regeneration we get out of that stump.
If you're cutting late summer, you might not get a ton of regeneration.
Yep. And if you're cutting a big tree, you may not get some regeneration, especially hardwoods.
Yep.
But I have seen ginormous oak trees be cut and stump sprouting like crazy.
It's kind of this weird conundrum.
To me, it's just like, throw your hat in the air.
It's like
50-50. Yeah. And
maybe
so,
you do, maybe you don't. So you do get...
Maybe I won't. That's what the oak's saying. Maybe I will regenerate. Maybe I won't. So you get that regeneration period.
You have a much longer period. Let's just say if you don't come back and do any type of management before you get to a closed canopy situation.
Yeah.
And you have way more sunlight, so you get the herbaceous cover that's hitting the coming up from the forest floor.
Yep.
You have the woody resprouts, but then... 5 years down the road, if you want to use prescribed fire will have a bigger impact on those woody resprouts as well as the vegetation. So if you have a bigger amount of sunlight, you don't have the buckbrush or the gooseberry to the same degree.
Yeah.
You might get in more grass component as well as the blackberry, the greenbrier, the goldenrod, the ragweed, the beggar's lice, all sorts of stuff. You just get a different suite of species coming back because you have more sunlight.
And at the same time, this gives you the ability to choose whether or not you want to treat it with a herbicide.
Yeah. If it's a noxious, if it's tree of heaven, if it's, or you just have a ton. How many places have we gone where it's just like 80% hickory?
Yeah, shagbark hickory.
I'm not going to not treat some of these trees, because I don't just need to take this from overstocked hickory to overstocked saplings.
Understory.
Yeah, understory.
I need to take this to a whole lot of dead stumps.
Yeah, I got to change this. I can't just reshape it. I need to eradicate. That's where the herbicide comes in and allow you to do that. Flush cutting really, really easily.
So flush cutting, we're going anywhere from big trees to little trees to saplings. Like
in anything.
Yep. Anything can
any
get
size.
Flush cut.
Yep.
Any species.
Yep.
Anything can get flush cut.
Absolutely.
We do. If we look at our bedding thickets or our temporary forest openings, and we're cutting, 75% of the cuts we do are flush cut.
Yeah.
And then within that 75%, we decide what the percentage of herbicide treatment is going to be.
Yes. But then you have so much more food availability, let's say, for a longer period of time by going in and just flush cutting.
Yeah.
Let's just say you just flush cut everything. You have a lot of food going back into those acres, and the usable space, because you're flush cutting, laying everything down flat against the ground.
Yep.
Deer, turkeys, other critters can go and move all the way through those cuts, most likely.
Deer and turkeys can hop over them. You can stack a couple of them on top of each other, and they're still to a point where they can walk over them.
I've been to some areas where it's grown so thick that you're like, wow, it's going to take a little bit of time for this to be useful. But what would have happened if you hadn't cut it? You know what I mean? Like, it still would have been really lacking and not very well used.
And this is why I like to cut in the winter. If you cut them with leaves still on the trees, it looks a whole lot thicker. And it stays a whole lot thicker.
And by having everything flush cut and laying flat against the ground, even if you have really high stock density or high stem density and you're like, wow, how can something move through here? Prescribed fire will consume those species because they actually go and they dry out.
Yeah.
And then the fire will consume them. I remember the temporary forest opening that you and Chad cut on the hillside.
Prairie Point.
It was like super, 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 super thick.
Yeah.
With like 4-inch oaks everywhere. You look down, it's like, how is something going to walk across that? Oh my gosh. Fire went through there. Wow. Where'd they go?
Yeah. Gone.
Gonzo.
Like snap of your fingers. But that's where the hinge cutting, not to get off the flush cutting, but that's where hinge cutting can come into play, because it doesn't get consumed in the fire nearly as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So you still have some woody structure
staying
through the fire.
Yep. Yep. There's
that's where that diversity
exactly.
would come in. I think we're going to go over that in the future, but that is because that's where everybody's thought went, well, what if I flush cut everything?
Yeah.
This is why. Flush cutting, if you were to do just one of these tools and you say, this is all I'm doing and I'm not going to do any of the other techniques.
It's flush cutting.
I'm flush cutting everything.
Yes, absolutely.
To me, they break down faster. There's automatically more sunlight on the ground. Deer and other turkey or other wildlife can move through much, much easier because they can step over the trees or move around the trees. There's a lot more usable space.
Yep. You have an acre of benefit.
One of the biggest
done.
Misconceptions, and there's a little bit of validity to it, but is the fact of it takes much longer to flush cut than it does any
timing,
of these other things.
Because that's why a lot of people are like, what's the rate here, guys? Like, how much can I cover? What can I do? This and that. It's like, it all depends on the actual timber composition. But you have the ability, in my opinion, if you know what you're doing, I would much rather flush cut an acre time-wise than try and hinge cut an acre. Like, I can move way faster flush cutting everything because I'm just cutting them. Like, I'm just letting them fall where they're naturally going to fall or where I need to place them. But
and typically, I don't have to return in 5 years and try to cut again.
Yeah,
like you might have to do with hinge cutting.
Yeah. But it is a little bit more labor intensive than the next technique we're going to talk about. But it's if you're going to do it, it's worth doing right the first time.
And at the same time, I'll have a rebuttal on a reminder for people, because the next technique is another very popular one.
Yeah.
And if side-by-side comparison, I'd take a man who's very skilled with this next one, and I'll say, we're going to cut 100 stems of...
Yep. Baseball bats.
Baseball bat-size things, trees. you're going to do it your way. I'm going to do it my way. We'll see who gets done faster.
Yeah.
And I'd almost put my next paycheck whenever that comes in. put that out there and say, if I'm not 5 minutes behind him, then you guys can have it.
Yeah.
Put it to a charity of your choice.
I wouldn't
choice.
Even say 5 minutes. I'd be 5 minutes ahead.
I think so. And much more beneficial to the wildlife.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So
that's one of the cons of flush cuttings. There's a little bit more, I would say, labor intensive.
Yeah.
Not necessarily time, but just labor intensive. It takes more energy to do it, to cut and run that chainsaw.
Yep.
But I'm doing it for the wildlife.
And one big thing, problem that I see with a lot of flush cutting is we stick to the understories. And we thin the understories, and we don't want to get into the big trees.
The mid-story
stuff.
But
honestly, the big trees are the ones that
occupy the sunlight.
Yeah, and those are the actual crop tree. It doesn't matter what species, but those are the crop tree because they're the ones controlling the next generation because they're bearing the seeds.
And if you don't know how to run a chainsaw,
hire somebody to do it.
Just or be careful and take the classes. Don't cut what you can't cut.
Yeah.
But that for that reason too, that's why we like diversity, and we'll get into that in a second.
Because we see a lot of cuts where, you know, we see them on neighboring properties or just purchased properties or properties in real estate where it's like, oh, they did a bunch of hinge cutting or did a bunch of cutting in here. They only cut the understory and the canopy's already closed back up.
And they didn't
all
get the
it
response.
Is brambles.
Yeah, they didn't get the response from vegetation that could have been far superior if they'd just gone ahead and cut.
Yeah.
And basically, the suite of species that you get when you get 30% sunlight in versus when you get 70% sunlight, completely different. And deer are going to respond, and other wildlife are going to respond much better and at a higher prevalence rate with the 70% sunlight species versus what comes back when you only get 30% sunlight.
And I should say this. This is a common thing that we say when we're cutting embedding thickets, and it's Genesis 1:3.
Okay.
And God said, let there be light.
Yeah.
And there was light.
When we finish up and we're packing up and it says, God said, let there be light, baby.
And there was light.
I can't tell you how many times you've started cutting, especially if you do it in the growing season, and it's like darker in the timber, and then you get done and you're in the hot sun. That's when you know you did a good job.
Yeah.
If you're still in the shade when you think you're done cutting,
cutting
in a bedding area,
if you don't find yourself saying Genesis 1:3 when you get done cutting, you probably need to cut some more.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. I like it. So the next one, hack and squirt. That's the other big technique
hack
that people
squirt,
are just
ma'am.
All about.
And girdling spray. We can throw
we'll
these kind of together.
Because both are using herbicide.
Yep.
And essentially, the purpose is to terminate that tree.
Yeah. Kill it with a herbicide.
Kill it
so
out.
So hack and squirt is typically with a hatchet or machete. You're chopping just through the bark into the cambium layer, and you're squirting a herbicide into that cambium layer to kill that tree.
Yes.
So the poison, the herbicide's going into the roots. And I sounded like a real green freak when I said that, didn't I?
I was like, ooh. Ooh, someone's not going to like
herbicide.
That.
Herbicide.
There's an email.
That herbicide. There's a bad review. We're spraying that herbicide in that cambium layer and killing that tree. So hack and squirt. Girdling spray is taking a chainsaw and sinking it in just through the bark, and you're just ringing that tree. And
so basically,
and
ringing is
it.
Walking all the way around with that saw in there to create a cut into the cambium.
And then you're spraying a herbicide into it.
Yes.
Another thing you see is just typically girdling. That's a technique that doesn't even need to be mentioned because I don't want anybody doing it because I don't see very good success with
I see horrible success. And that's basically, just double girdle it. Put two bands around
seen
that tree.
Seen it jump like crazy.
Ineffective. If you're going to girdle, use herbicide.
Yep. If you want the tree dead, use herbicide.
Yeah.
So,
hack and squirt.
Hack and squirt, basically, you know, the pros to it is you can move pretty quickly through the timber. You can kill a lot of trees pretty quickly. But by killing that tree, you're taking all the energy, all the years of growth, and erasing it, saying, you're no good to me. And
it's a complete 100% restart.
Yeah.
Like, but it's a So we talked about like the tree species of, okay, you have some that are like timber value or hard mass value that need a good canopy to produce a food value. But there's a lot of other species that when you cut them, the regeneration is very beneficial.
Oh, phenomenal.
And all you have to do is cut them. Elm, red maple.
Dogwood, even hickories in a lot of places. I love to see them regenerating. And if you
black gum is another big one.
If you go in and you say this is bad, I'm going to kill it with a hack and squirt. You're going well. Now we have to wait. We have to hope that we're killing enough trees to get sunlight on the forest floor to then something to germinate and start growing. And much of the whitetails range, much of the United States, woody browse is lacking. Down south, it's not as needed because
your winters aren't very wintery.
Yeah, so browse is coming in the more of a herbaceous
form. You have a longer
form.
Growing season, too.
Yeah, so if you plant for woody browse in Georgia, if you're not managing it, it can grow out of reach of a whitetail deer pretty quickly.
Yep.
Up in the north, there's a good chance they're going to keep consuming it in reach to
into
where it
the
stays
dirt.
Within yeah. reach. So woody browse, don't let anything fool you. It's a crucial part of a whitetail's deer diet. And by hack and squirt a girdling spray, we lose out on that value.
Absolutely you do. You take it right off the table.
So for example, when do we use hack and squirt? Typically it's an understory type management tool of certain species dominating the understory that aren't going to provide woody browse. I think of specifically when I see tulip poplar, eastern hop hornbeam or ironwood, American hornbeam or musselwood, sweet gum, Those are some of the ones that I can think of. I know you're trying to think of a few more, but when you see an understory filled with these little, baseball bat size, that's when we use hack and squirt. I don't typically go into hack and squirt a bunch of 8-inch oaks or a bunch of 12-inch walnuts or whatever with hack and squirt. I'd much rather use that root mass and provide
for
some benefit.
Yeah.
And cut that tree so I get some immediate cover.
Because here's the thing.
And if I cut it at the right time of the year, I get immediate food.
Yeah, absolutely you do. But here's the thing of like that tree, let's just say it's an 8-inch oak. It's maybe 20 years old. So it's got a 20-year-old root system. Pretty dang stout root system,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a lot of energy.
A lot of energy production. So if I cut that, I'm going to get a way more forage immediately from that tree than if I'm trying to go in and plant other trees or shrubs. It's basically, at that point, a surrogate shrub. I'm just changing the shape of that tree and making it more shrub and bushy-like and allowing it to be providing benefit in the form of forage and cover, but by killing it with herbicide, I haven't allowed that to occur. And maybe that's not necessarily the goals of those acres, or maybe I have that elsewhere on the property, then we can use hack and squirt, or maybe it's just a species we don't want to regenerate at all. But we have to remember, when you're using herbicide, you're done. Like,
yep.
You've toasted that tree. It's out of there. But if you're not putting or placing value and looking at the composition of deer's diet across an entire year, you could be potentially removing a potential valuable resource off that property by simply only using the hack and squirt method. Doesn't make much sense to just use that. The other standpoint of, I'm always going to recommend on most properties prescribe fire to then maintain that habitat once I get it to the position, the condition, stage that I want.
Yeah.
But if I have gone through an entire 20-acre
this
unit...
This is what I hate about
girdling
spray and hack and squirt.
If I've gone through and I have that 20-acre woodlot in this scenario, and I have 1,000 dead trees in that 20 acres...
In varying sizes. And a snag can... Well, go ahead. I'll jump ahead.
I am going to be I can't say that phrase. I am going to be very nervous to be placing fire in those 20 acres because I have seen dead snags burn before. Yeah. And if I have one that has 1,000 dead snags, what am I doing? It kind of goes back.
You have to wait or you have to go in and cut those things down.
Wait. So you're telling me I should just cut them down in the first place?
And it would be a whole lot easier on a chainsaw to cut them down when they're green
rather than
when they're dead and dried.
Absolutely.
A snag is a woody structure, any flammable.
Dried out, 1,000-hour fuel.
It could be anything flammable that's above the ground. It could be a treetop. It could be a broom handle stuck in the ground.
A witch's dead snag.
It could be a crashed witch broom.
Yeah.
And
if
it catches
flying in your
fire,
area, we ain't coming.
If it catches fire, it's going to throw embers however far in the wind.
And because it's
cancer on a fire is having dead snags.
That's fire rule number one. It's walk the line, know where your snags are.
Yeah.
And when you're done burning, go and check your snags.
Yeah.
But if I have 1,000 snags that I intentionally did, well, that was dumb on my part.
If you're getting hack and squirt and fire recommended, or you're thinking I'm going to do hack and squirt and fire, you're inviting a lawsuit or a neighbor.
You're asking that fire to at some point jump the line.
Yeah.
That just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
If you want to utilize it for a portion or a couple trees that you don't feel comfortable felling because they're very large, go ahead, girdle it, spray it, but make sure it's the interior of your fire line.
Yeah.
And I might do that for a couple, but I am in no way, shape, or form going to go into an entire area and do it myself, nor recommend it, because I know what I want to do later on. Kind of goes back to the hinge cut. I'm probably not going to go hinge them because then my prescribed fire isn't going to reset that vegetation. I'm going to have to go back in mechanically or with herbicide and do it. I should have just done it right from the beginning. And what I mean right is...
What's the phrase? Measure twice and cut once.
Yeah. Think about what this area is going to be down the road and how I'm going to need to manage it to get the benefit out of these acres 5, 10, 20 years down the road. Doesn't make sense to create it. All you've done is just create another task for you to do. This is supposed to be fun. This is supposed to be enjoyable. Enjoy your land. But if I can use prescribed fire to do that work for me, rather than going back in and cutting more,
it's 80 grit management. Something that you're going to have to do twice, you're making it 220. And you should be focused on other places of your property rather than going back and cutting there. I hack and swear, now I'm going to go back and cut so I can burn. It's crash.
It's like I'm not going to create the more work for myself.
Yeah. So clearly it's hack and squirt ranks down on the list for us on utilizing because, you know, you're losing out on the energy of the tree. You're losing out on that immediate cover. You're losing out on that potential regeneration of food and cover.
Mm-hmm.
You're creating snags if you're doing very big ones at all. So it's basically interior fire units on the understory that's densely stacked is where I would say that's probably where I would do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not around the edges, not along your road systems. It's not that application.
If I'm drawing a line somewhere in northern Missouri, straight, let's say, northern Missouri, the north border of Kentucky, southern Ohio, kind of along that line. Anything north of that woody browse is crucial.
Yeah.
That late winter woody browse. So you shouldn't most likely do hack and squirt unless there's an invasive species you're just trying to control.
Yeah, or
outside
you just
of
have
that, I'd be trying to maximize woody browse.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be hack and squirting at all.
Yep.
But if I'm down south, I may be doing it a lot more.
Again, you've just heard, 3 to 4 different techniques. I'm throwing the girdling in with the hack and squirt. Because essentially the end result's the same thing. 3 different combos, ways of techniques that are highly debated, but they all have pros and cons.
Yep.
So this goes back to, if I have 3 different ways to skin this cat of doing timber management that I know from the beginning of the podcast I need to be doing, how do I implement all these different techniques? Because we can, and again, going back to that building house mentality of, I've got all these tools, I should probably utilize them to some degree. I can't just utilize just the one.
Yeah.
So when it comes to hinge cutting, the trees that we like to hinge, prefer to hinge, are 6 inches in diameter and below.
Yep.
And it's like the red maple, the flowering dogwood, some hickories, American elm. Those black gums, those puppies are the ones that are like, woo.
Those are awesome.
I'm gonna hinge some
not
of those.
Not all of them.
No, not all of them.
But
because
of course,
guess what? If I flesh cut them, they're still gonna stump sprout.
Yeah.
And that's perfect. That's what I want. So I can incorporate that into the mixture of flush cutting. We know we're going to do quite a bit, a larger majority of flush cutting, because we're going to get the vegetative response that we want. We can do it safely. We know how to cut. And I'm going to make this acre more usable at the same time. But maybe I get to a couple trees, or maybe I have someone who wants to help me in this timber unit who doesn't know how to run a chainsaw.
Or it's the center of a big fire unit and they're big trees, I may girdle and spray those.
Yeah.
Just to kill them.
And I will say this. I guess if we're going to put one down over the other, I'm not hacking and squirting.
I'm
definitely
going to
girdle it
and
spray. I have had so many trees that's like, why did that not work? Why did that not work? Why did that not work?
You know why?
I put too many. And honestly, one of the other reasons is make sure you read the herbicide label. There's an ideal temperature that those herbicides will work in.
Yeah.
And if you're not doing that temperature range, it may not be effective.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work that is like, crap.
Yep.
But girdle it and spray it. Because I have also hacked some trees where it worked on portions of the trees. And you look up in the canopy and you come back and you're like, what did that gum? I got an eighth of the tree that's still green.
And it may kill it 2 years from now. It's like a slow death. And
just expedite it. Just cut it.
Yeah.
Or cut it and treat it, or girdle it and
be
spray
a man.
It.
It feels a lot more manly to cut it with a chainsaw anyway.
Well, when that tree drops, it shakes shakes the ground. Like, yeah, I just did that.
Yeah. You kind of beat your chest a little bit. But when I hack and squirt, I'm like, phew!
I hacked you.
I think in between the hack and squirt, like in between trees, you have to skip a
you
few
do.
Times.
It's more of like a leprechaun leap.
There's like a mandatory ribbon you have to twirl to.
It's weird. Like immediately after I'm done running a chainsaw, they have to shave my chest or it's just out of control. It's so manly.
Yeah. So combine that. Let's look at a bedding thicket in it. We got a 20-acre unit. We put in 3 bedding thickets that are 1 acre in size. So we got a total of 3 acres.
Yep.
It's a diversity of cuts. We've hinge cut a third of them,
sure.
And we flush cut the other
two-thirds.
Yeah.
Just numbers.
I was thinking ahead. I was going, okay, and then we're going to do some hack and squirt in the remainder of the 20 acres.
Sure.
We could
do that on some of the other trees because, again, let's just say I
don't do any hack and squirt in a bedding thicket.
No.
Because I want woody browse and I want cover and I want a thick, gnarly
mess.
Designed method to the madness mess.
But the 17 acres that remain outside of the 3 that are pretty much clear cut, those things can have all of these techniques utilized in them, and those 17 acres need to be
probably
addressed.
Not as much hinge cutting because we want our bedding thickets to be. When we send fire through, we want the bedding thickets to have the structure in them. We want the timber to be a mix of herbaceous plants and grasses.
And
one thing about hack and squirt,
well.
Too, I want to mention is when you do the hack and squirt with the goal of getting native or herbaceous plants and grasses, that's all great during the growing season, but after the first frost, it's wide open again. That woody browse from a regenerating stump or a hinge-cut tree is food through the winter.
And the brambles grow all up in amongst them.
Yeah.
When you have a standing
even
dead
the
tree.
Even grasses, too, and it provides better cover.
You have a standing dead tree, greenbrier doesn't really hardly grow up it because the canopy is way, way, way out of reach. But if you have a canopy that has been flush cut and the canopy is laying down on the ground, you have blackberry, you have greenbrier growing across it, and that cover visually is much more dense and stays a heck of a lot better throughout the winter time frame than something that's just
so our flush cut with herbicide, without herbicide, that's an all-American cut. Your hinge cut might make all state might he definitely makes all district. Hackett Squirt, he probably checks out at all conference.
I wasn't good giving him all conference. He went. He came into the.
He came into the game
and sure he had a block. Cool.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. He hit that three with yeah, the, 2 minutes left
jumper.
On the clock.
Good
yeah.
job.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of how they rank. They all need to be used.
Yeah.
They all can be used. I would encourage you to use mainly the flush cutting and hinge cutting first. And the hack and squirt can be more of a, I need to just knock this out and I need to move quickly. And
yeah.
all these species aren't highly selected for browse, so I'm just going to knock them out. Tulip
yeah.
poplar is a big one because it grows so stinking fast.
But
yeah, yeah and I mean, all of that above in one little phrase I'll read to you, like when you're doing your bedding thicket cuts, keep this in mind. In the beginning, you're going to like this. In the beginning, God created heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. This is the beginning of the Bible, okay?
Yeah.
And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that light was good. It gets better and better. And God separated the light from darkness. Fellas, when you're cutting in these bedding thickets, we need light.
We need
separate it from the darkness.
Yeah. The low value of the remaining timber, get sunlight in there. Don't be afraid to cut. That's the whole purpose. That's
diversity
what we want.
Of cuts.
You've got to have that response to be able to make the difference, see the difference that you're wanting on the landscape. At the end of the day, there is a big stigma of addressing the timber, cutting timber. Don't be afraid. Face your fears. Learn about it. Identify
yep.
trees. Learn what they are. Learn what role they have.
Start
what
cutting.
Value they
if
have.
You haven't ran a saw much, start on the small things
yes.
first.
Yes.
Cut those.
Learn how to do it. Begin to implement it. And if you don't, if the learning curve is too steep, we'll come help you.
That's right.
I mean, yeah. That's what we do. We love to be able to do that. We love to be able to see these transformations, and
we want to make sure you do it right the first time.
I do
and
not.
And bedding thickets
yes.
are great, but a bedding thicket in the wrong spot on the farm
is a headache
from now to the second coming of Jesus
yes.
Christ. Like, it's going to be that way for a long, long time, and you may have to. Sit there and gripe about it for a long, long time.
Yeah.
But if you get it in the right place, woo-wee, it's phenomenal.
It is sweet. But it's awesome. And I know you've been getting them too, to have people from Oklahoma, Ohio, West Virginia, South Carolina, all across the country on a weekend.
Pennsylvania,
sending you messages and where it's like, there's sunlight there.
Yeah.
Like these fellas.
Illinois,
are out
I just
there.
Got one 2 days yesterday, I think.
Iowa, these fellas are getting out there and cutting some stuff down. They're
yep.
not afraid. They're ripping the Band-Aid off, and they're
yep.
getting after it. And that's what I'd like to see. Action, habitat.
It's kind of a good news, bad news, guys. Good news is those guys out there doing it, you got the leg up on your neighbors. Neighbors that are listening to neighbors to our clients, you better get to work.
Absolutely. I hope that this podcast was good. I hope... Honestly, I hope that it was just like clarity for what each one of these techniques does, the pros and cons. And I hope that it was also refreshing to say, guys, you can do all of them. You don't have to pick one.
Yeah.
You can do a variety, like we choose to do, of all these different techniques, but just utilize it in the right way.
Yeah. Don't get stuck on one tool.
That is fuel for you to an encouragement to say, get off the couch. Don't be scared to implement it. Just begin to implement it.
It's like
and
a
learn
basketball
learn
player
yourself.
Who goes and all he does in practice is shoot free throws.
Yeah.
And he never practices shooting with a defender.
Yeah.
Well, if all we do is practice hinge cuts, it's like, well, that's great for that one little bit, but we need to be able to play the whole spectrum. We need to be able to play the whole court. We need to have a diversity to our skill set.
Cutting timber and managing timber on 20 acres is a season. Like, yeah. it's not a game. It's not a shot in a game. It is, like, it's bigger scale. You got to know how to react in that environment. Yep. And to be able to do that, you have to be able to be skilled and learn how to hinge cut, learn how to flush cut, learn how to fell trees, learn what they need to be, if they need to be treated, or if they need to be hacked, whatever. You have to have that knowledge. But you're not going to get it by sitting back and wondering which one I should use and which one I shouldn't.
Yep.
Some of it's just learning by doing. And here's the other good thing. Guess what? If you get sunlight into the forest floor, winning. Yeah.
You could hinge cut and you're going to get sunlight to the, like, you'll get sunlight. You may not get the long-term benefit, but at least you got sunlight. So you made the change.
You made some improvement.
The worst thing you can do in a closed canopy woodlot is let it remain a closed canopy woodlot.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Yeah. Do something.
If you went hack and squirted all the weed trees, I'd be like, ugh, I wish you'd have talked to us first. But at the same time, at least you got rid of the weed trees.
You improved it.
Yeah.
You just made a headache for yourself, but you improved
it. Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, lots of different scenarios, guys. If you have questions, please go to landlegacy.tv. Go to the consultation tab, email in. We love getting questions. Or go to social media, Instagram and Facebook. Let us know what your thoughts are. Let us know if you implemented some of these techniques too, and what you find is the best working.
Send us pictures of the ones you put in too, before and afters. We'll share them on our page.
Absolutely. We'll see you guys next week.